During the 12 years, 1788 to 1800, revolutions took place. There was the rise of liberalism, democracy, republicanism, and nationalism, and also a brutal conflict between Orthodox Russia and the Muslim Ottoman Empire. And interestingly, the world during those years was far more interconnected than is generally believed. Jay Winnick's new book, The Great Upheaval, America and the Birth of the Modern World, 1788 to 1800, is published by Harper. And I'm very pleased it brings Mr. Winnick back to this show. It's always a pleasure to see you, and congratulations. The book is already on the bestseller list. So what is the great upheaval of your title? I thought maybe it should have been The Great Upheavals.
You know, that's actually well stated. The Great Upheaval, in effect, talks about what I believe is the most significant era in all of human history. On one hand, it saw a struggling America fighting for its life at home and abroad. It witnessed the monumental French Revolution, whose effects touched all four corners of the globe and upended the greatest monarchy in Europe. It saw this savage clash between the Christian West and the Islamic Empire. And hope against hope, it saw a struggling democracy somehow survive. And it's really an extraordinary story, and it's one which has typically been lost to history because we tend to forget that the great leaders of the day watched each other, reacted to each other, and responded to each other. And that's how the modern world was really formed.
So is it fair to say that you subscribe to the great man, I should say great man and woman, theory of history? Because you're talking about the leaders.
Right.
This is a top-down approach.
No. I subscribe to both. I think you both have to look at bottom-down events and larger historical forces at work, such as ideas and ideals. For example, in this period, the idea of revolution, this idea that when the French came back with these stirring stories that these young American colonists had thrown off the yoke of an unjust king and created a representative government, and they thought they too could do it. So I subscribe to that, but absolutely I also subscribe to the idea that great leaders, for good or for ill, change the course of history.
And the success or failure of the American Constitution and the French Revolution came down to the characters of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Lafayette, Robespierre, Danton, Marat, later right. Napoleon?
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at these...
Because there could have been Washingtons and Jeffersons in France as well, couldn't there?
There could have been. And what we see in America is despite all the stresses and the strains and despite the Whiskey Rebellion in which we could have gone down the same bloody path of the French, somehow George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, though they often hated each other, they stayed true to the ideas and ideals of the Constitution. In France, by contrast, you had Louis XVI, who was an enormously weak leader, and though they tried to go in the same direction as America, he was ultimately swallowed up by the French Revolution. You know, Catherine the Great, the Empress of Russia, when she looked at what was happening in France, as they sought to first enact something like an America, and then they lost total control of it. And not only did Louis XVI lose control of the revolution, but he lost his own head. Well, you know what she said at the time? She said, give me 20,000 Cossacks, and I will end this revolution in 2 weeks. And I think it's safe to say if Washington had been in France or if Catherine the Great had been in France, we probably would have seen a very different alternative.
Well, Catherine the Great initially supported the American Revolution. It was the French one that turned her?
Right. No, Leonard, that's a really good question. You know, historians tend to overlook that Catherine played a significant role in America's founding. What she did is when King George III came to her, he asked for her hardened Cossacks and her navy to put down these upstart colonials. And she said no. In fact, far not
they would only, have joined the Hessians.
They wouldn't have even gone to the Hessians. They would have just used the Russians. And instead what she did is she formed something called the League of Armed Neutrality, in which she created this coalition of Western powers that diplomatically isolated Britain. And in that sense, she helped midwife America to independence. But when the French Revolution galloped and became increasingly bloody and the terror and violence began to mark its every step, she was totally turned off to the revolution. And that's when, in Russia itself, she turned her back on decades of enlightenment and became a reactionary.
Now, in the French Revolution, you have all these people fighting each other for power. In the American Revolution, you have people who didn't agree on a lot of things. And even the ones who did agree, like Adams with Washington, he still referred to Washington as old muttonhead, a man who couldn't spell. And we see Adams and Jefferson fighting in the cabinet, Alexander Hamilton trying to establish himself as a law unto himself. But they had they still had a shared vision? Is that what is that one of the big differences?
Right. Well, this is really not only the great story of the 1790s and the great story of the Great Upheaval, but it's one of the great stories really of all time. And the fact is what I came across in my research is just how precarious and fragile the young infant republic was. And given all their hatreds of each other, you know, particularly during the Whiskey Rebellion, or for example, you know, in the Whiskey Rebellion, Washington, he saw these rebels carrying mock guillotines. They were toasting Robespierre, the bloodthirsty dictator of France. They were threatening to march in Philadelphia, and Washington even couldn't rule out that they would accept French sponsorship, both military as well as diplomatic. But in the end, despite all this, Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, who often hated each other, somehow they never deviated from their constitution, which the French did and which the Russians did. And it was their tolerance of in a multiplicity of views that really marked the Americans and made them different from all the other countries in the rest of the world.
Do you think it's because they came out of a slightly different tradition? I mean, the French were coming out of a monarchy in the same way that people have said right. that in Russia we went from the czar to a czar to a, you know, a czar.
Right. Well, no, there is no doubt that the passions and the hatreds were really pent up and deep-seated in a place like France. But, you know, if you look at it in Russia, Russia, Catherine had her own rebellion, the Pugachev Rebellion, which she compared to the colonists in America, but she put it down quite harshly and forcefully. In the Americans' case, what they did, which was so remarkable, and they did this even despite, you know, during the newspaper war, in which Washington was always being criticized, and there were even cartoons in which one cartoon compared him to Louis XVI being marched off to the guillotine. And when this was at the height of the terror, and he worried that would be his fate as well. But in the end, having come out of the English tradition, and more than that, these extraordinary men, they believed their words. That's what made them different.
Well, there was a precedent that Washington set in American politics by not running for a third term. That set the stage for John Adams' abdication of power to Jefferson after he lost in 1801. This is perhaps the first peaceful transfer of power in human history.
No, it really was.
When we look at the history of the British kings all killing each other to gain power, this is kind of shocking.
Yeah, it really is shocking. I mean, typically what happened when you transferred power, it was only because you were going to the guillotine, you were going to be beheaded, or you were going into exile, like what happened to Napoleon. And what Washington did is he turned power over, and as King George III once said, by God, if he does that, sir, he will be the greatest man on the planet. And though his peers didn't recognize him as such, in the long lens of history, and though he was often stilted, he wasn't the most brilliant man of his day, he wasn't the wisest man or the most eloquent, but he was a visionary in terms of the science of government, and he set the tone.
Does the explanation for how different the experiences in the two countries were go beyond the great man theory and have also something to do with the fact that America was geographically isolated from Europe, didn't have the same historical baggage that their European counterparts had?
Right, right. No, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's a significant factor in America somehow, despite its struggles at home and abroad, to survive. But it's important to realize that during the momentous events in France, there was this great war hysteria and war fervor in America in which we literally worried that France, that Napoleon, whose armies were gobbling up the states of Europe, as was put at the time, leaf by leaf like the heads of an artichoke. And John Adams, as well as Washington, worried he would come to America next. So there was concerns, and it was touch and go. But in the end, in a quirk of fate, Napoleon went into the Middle East instead of going to America.
Before Napoleon, I've always wondered why. It's one thing for people to try to seize power. It's another thing for the French Revolution to have devolved into this spasm of gore and terror. That was absolutely unnecessary, wasn't it?
No, it really was unnecessary. And repeatedly, you saw the revolutionaries somehow trying to get a control on it. I mean, think of some of the ghastly events that happened. During the September massacres, women would have their legs spread open and fires would be lit beneath them. Priests would have their hands bound together in the Vendée, and they would be drowned. In the Pont de Sûr, elderly people would be marched out in the fields where they'd be forced to dig their own mass graves, and then they would be shot. Of course, the SS did that. And one distinguished French chemist, and remember, Washington was the most civilized monarchy in the world at the time, seen as answerable only to God. Well, one distinguished French chemist actually proposed the use of poison gas to speed the killing, of course, presaging what happened at Auschwitz. And in that sense, the French Revolution, rather than going in the path of the American Revolution, or even in Russia, which went authoritarian, it laid the seeds, despite its high ideals, for the worst of totalitarianism that we saw really in Nazi Germany. It was a great tragedy and very poignant and sad.
Although the French learned their lesson, didn't they? I mean, they although 1868 could have devolved into that sort of thing, it didn't.
Right. No. In the end, they eventually found their way. I mean, they had seen so much bloodshed and turmoil that the country was exhausted and they yearned for a more civilized existence.
Is it true that you learned French so you could research this book?
You know, I did. And, you know, the book took 6 years to research. You know, people have always asked me, how did April 1865 do? And that took me 4 years. This took 6 years. And I learned French for a year and a half, or about 2 years. And the reason why I did that is because it gave me a greater sense and a feel for the characters. I believe to do research well, you have to live in the heads and the hearts of the actors. That's why learning French was so important.
But also because it was the language of Europe, wasn't it? If you want to know what Catherine the Great was thinking, you'd have to know French, because didn't she write most of her things in French rather than Russian?
Not only did she write most of her things in French, and she always spoke Russian with a bad accent, but for example, when John Paul Jones, one of our great naval heroes, went to Russia, and of all things, to fight for her against what they regarded as the heathen Muslims, what was so fascinating is he presented her a copy of the Constitution. And she said, and this is an extraordinary scene, and she said, I've no doubt it will stimulate others like it. But their conversation took place in the language of the court of St. Petersburg, which was in French.
My guest is Jay Winnick, who's the author of April 1865, his last book, which was a number one New York Times bestseller. Now also on the bestseller list, his latest, called The Great Upheaval, America and the Birth of the Modern World, 1788 to 1800, published by Harper. It's commonly believed that communication during the late 18th century was slow and incomplete, but you write, I'm quoting, there was an uncommon fluidity of the age, almost unheard of even today. Intellectuals, advisors, military men, and ideas freely crossed borders, changed allegiances, settled in, and then moved on. So how did these ideas get across the pond with such fluidity?
Right. You know, it did take time for the ideas to get across, but it was an enormously interconnected age, I think more than today. And the reason why is because people would go from one country to another country in this struggle to shape the world, whether it was the notion of constitutional republicanism or democracy or Allah's law or enlightened despotism. And you see, for example, Thomas Jefferson would advise the French revolutionaries. Thaddeus Kosciuszko led a rebellion in Poland, inspired by the ideals of the American Revolution against Catherine the Great. John Paul Jones went to go fight for Catherine. And one last example, the Comte de Ségur, who fought with distinction with Washington in our rebellion in the Revolutionary War, well, he then went to St. Petersburg. So we see that these people, in a remarkable assemblage of characters, the greatest galaxy of actors the world has ever seen, they felt they were creating the world anew.
Well, you write about Thaddeus Kosciuszko, who hoped to establish a new government in Poland in 1791, modeled after the American government. And what did he get for his trouble?
What he got for his trouble? Look, he was
the end of Poland.
The end of Poland. And this again is an extraordinary story, particularly if you're trying to understand the American founders and the founding period for the Americans and how tenuous it was. He led this rebellion, and it seemed to be succeeding at first, but in the end it was totally crushed, and he screamed almost near his death. He said, Poland is immortal. But Catherine the Great literally spearheaded an effort that would wipe Poland off the face of the map. And of course, this sent a powerful signal to George Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and Adams about the perils of military weakness. And that's why during the Quasi-War with France, and as Napoleon's armies were storming through country after country, they were worried it could happen next with them.
And Catherine was also engaged in conflicts with the Ottoman Empire. How was she able to carry all of this on?
Yeah, well Catherine was, I mean, she is, look, if I were at a dinner party with Jefferson and Washington and the bloodthirsty dictator Robespierre, Napoleon and Catherine, I would certainly want to know Washington because I think he was the master spirit of the age. But I would probably want Catherine as my dinner party. She was for 30 years the most influential monarch on the world stage. She was called the dominatrix of Europe. She was a hero of all the Enlightenment philosophes, Voltaire. She drew on Montesquieu 20 years before the founders did in governing Russia, but she took one set of principles, we took another. And then she was an empire builder. She fought against the Muslims. She fought against Sweden. She tried to contain the French Revolution. And she turned Russia not only into a much more Europeanized state, but she turned it into the mighty power that we tend to know of today.
But didn't Russia then turn its back on Europe for a little while?
Yes. I mean, in the end, Russia sort of withdrew, but that was only after her death. I mean, but she really helped pull it into the modern society.
And actually, it led to all of those conflicts within Russia as to whether to be Europeanized or whether to be Slavicized.
Right. That was an enduring conflict that though she tried to distinctly point in one direction, although I think it's safe to say that even in Catherine's case, she always had a mixed sense of what Russia was about. On one hand, she wanted it to be civilized. She wanted it to have the finest schools, the best education, to write the best books. But on the other hand, Russians often disdainfully referred to America and Europe as the peninsula. And she did nothing to change that. So she played both sides against the middle, in a sense.
In the epilogue, you write, it was then the decade that made the modern world. True, much remained to be done, but much had already been accomplished. To contemplate the seeds of the 1790s of republics and revolution, of democratic hopes and liberalism, of totalitarianism and religious war, too, is to begin to understand the tides that have swept the globe and battered nations large and small ever since. So all of these things just really came into effect here?
Right. And in this remarkable time, I mean, this was a period of just extraordinary percolation. And this was where the shape of the modern world happened. Of course, in America's case, we set the world down one path. First, constitutional republicanism. And then when Thomas Jefferson became president and he said momentously, we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists, then we eventually created the first seeds of democracy. In France's case, they undid a great monarchy, but by the same token, they went into this bloodthirsty path that riddled Europe and ended in an ocean of tears and blood for really 100 years. In Russia's case, Russia, having started out having admiring the Americans, including George Washington, then turned harshly authoritarianism and set the world down another path. And then finally, with the Muslim world, there was this great jihad against the Muslims, both on Catherine's part as well as Napoleon's. And I think we're paying the price for that even to this day.
You say in the introduction that 1788 to 1800 is arguably the most important in human history. And one critic was curious about why you left out any mention of England's glorious revolution of 1688, in which the power of the monarch was decisively curbed. Parliament became an equal player. And it's a key to understanding everything else that followed as well, isn't it?
No. I mean, look, there's no doubt that Britain played a significant role. And in the Great Upheaval, I do talk a great deal about Britain. And Britain was a crucial factor. They tried to rein in the French Revolution. They wore this kind of civilizing, moderating influence at the time, although they did have a coalition with Russia. But there's one other thing that I would say to that. To have done what I did in The Great Upheaval, no book like this has ever been written before that interweaves a kind of great global narrative and puts the context of the events of the founders in this larger setting. And I would maintain that you cannot understand the events of early America without seeing it in the shape, in the context of these cataclysmic events. So it was nothing like this had been done. France, America, Russia, the Islamic world. If I had put more about Britain in there and made that an equal player, I just think it would have been too unmanageable for the reader. And one thing that I feel is important, and I've been told that my strength is a strong narrative drive and to write compellingly, you don't want to overwhelm the reader. And had I added a fourth, or really a fifth actor, I think it would have been too much.
Well, your last book, April 1865, dealt with the end of the Civil War in America. You weren't dealing with the larger landscape of France, Russia, Poland, and the United States during a 12-year period. This book, The Great Upheaval, America and the Birth of the Modern World, 1788 to 1800, is published by Harper's. And Jay Winnick will be reading and signing at the Chelsea Barnes & Noble store, 675 6th Avenue, at 7 p.m. tonight. I want to thank you so much for being with us. What's next, the history of the world?
You know, look, I've done the end of the Civil War. I've done this. I don't know yet.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Leonard, it's always great to be here.
On tomorrow's show, a look at labor abuse today, even outright slavery in Florida, Oklahoma, and the U.S.-owned Pacific island of Saipan. Then the foods and customs of Syrian Jews, plus the great French jazz pianist Marshall Salal, who's celebrating his 80th birthday in New York. And David Cronenberg discusses his latest movie, Eastern Promises, and why he seems to court controversy. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Bridget Bergen, Barbara Kahn, Stephanie Hughes, Angela Sheldon, and Scott Goldberg. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.